Blog Talk Radio.
For ideas, put them out there, and never claiming to be right. I'm at an age where I don't know if the difference between right and wrong is as clear as it once was to me. Everything seems to be, in truth, nuanced. Facts, the things that I believe, are important and critical. I do believe, as the ancients taught us, that everybody's opinion is valid. Everybody has an opinion, and it differs. Except for the troglodytes out there who try to assert that their opinion is more important than the rest. Tedious a lot, aren't they? No. There are, though, truths amongst all those opinions. And who am I to say that I can identify the truth? Except I know it. I'm trying to struggle to understand it. Just like you. Accuracy, but accuracy, getting it right somehow. In the meantime, it's constant discovery, new facts, new information. Our children are brilliant, and we're teaching them and giving them a leg up, giving them all the best of what we have and what we have learned, and hoping that they will do well in their endeavors. Preparation for a lifestyle in the past is part of a disconnect for a lot of little people. The parents doing what they think is best, doing what they think what is familiar to them, so that they can trust it. But when you pull back a few, you step back a bit, you notice that children aren't being prepared to live in the past. They're preparing to live in the future, and it's our task to equip them with the skills and knowledge that they need so that they can make meaningful and healthy decisions and cope in this struggle. And it should be a struggle, but for some, the struggle is unbearable. And we are saddened by that reality. For others, the struggle somehow is a reason to wake up every single day, greet the sun, get on with our life, and do the best that we can in the moment, and striving to do better tomorrow, whatever the circumstance. Now, that sounds a bit Pollyanna. Well, yeah, it is, I think. That's fair. Optimism always sounds that way to cynics. Us, we're part of a very unique brotherhood. Now you think, if we could all lean into this private, personal conversation like you and I are having right now, think about it. Think about what we could do. What would happen if our imagination and our understanding of the opportunity within Freemasonry were to come to some level of fruition? We could do wonderful things. So lately I've been concerned and thinking that what I see around me, often the concern isn't the beauty of Freemasonry. That's not something that you or I can tamper with. We can have opinions about it, but we can't tamper with it. We can ball up our little fists and have an active distemper. We can act foolish about these ideas. There's so much that we can legitimately claim we just don't know. Is it a measure and an examination of ego? Well, oh my goodness, yes, always has been at some level. But that's not a point that you walk around with every single moment, is it? Unless you're 12th or 13th century monk, or your sense of the great creator is punitive. Guidance, Freemasonry, always challenged as being a bit of a wannabe religion, but it isn't. Simply examination of our nature, outside of the superstition. But remember, brethren, I'm a deist. I am what I am. The examination. Every day, it's about discovery. Those new facts that change our sense of reality. And gladly. So if we're bright enough and a bit silly enough to think that nothing is real, well, all right, what are you going to do with that? Where are you going with that? What is real is this purposeful change, this craving, this appetite for learning, discovery. I know it's a bit transparent. You tune into Masonic Effects. We play in the background, in the foreground. We play with the notions of the ancient Greeks, lyrical poetry, poetry that was meant to be sung. Music was important. What did they know that we didn't know? But we play with the notions of jazz, constant. What's jazz if not innovation? Something a little different, tweaking. Innovation that we can explore and absorb, the experience in the moment. No, we don't look at the world through an iPhone lens, or stop during a performance to take pictures or send you pictures of my breakfast. Oh, sorry. I'll spare you that. Be selective. Raise yourself to the level that you feel comfortable with, but always raise yourself. Yeah. We have a wonderful show today, and this is there's a bit of a reveal going on here today. Yep. The poetry today, you know, we mix symbolism and the commentary with poetry and music. The poetry today comes from the ancients, about 400 and some odd BC, from Homer, no less. And of course, silly of me. I'll read to you a passage from the Iliad and tell you a little bit about Homer and why it's so important. But you don't have to revel in it. You don't have to pay any attention to it. But the question is, do you need to, and would you benefit from it? That's on you, my brother. That's for you to ask yourself. Thoughtful conversation usually makes us feel quite good inside. even the angry and people that are confused can find some sense of purpose in what we offer here at Masonic Effects. So the intimacy might appeal to you again this week. Ah, a bit of an acknowledgement that's necessary today to listeners coming to us from the Netherlands and Portugal and the United Kingdom. Hopefully that will continue to last after October 31st. And Japan, thank you for tuning in. And Australia, it's an honor. The United States, that giant machine of idea and innovation, that experiment in capitalism and democracy, and that's being bruised and battered as it moves on in time. And my nation, Canada. Thank you for tuning in. Now, let me sit back and attempt in my own way to inform and entertain. And this is some material by a pianist, Tommy Flanagan, along with John Coltrane. And yeah, you'll get it. You'll get the idea. Kenny Burrell. Yeah. Check this out. Thank you. Sometimes things just start off right, don't you think? Lovely. Idris Suleiman, Kenny Burrell, John Coltrane, and Tommy Flanagan. An album called The Cat, of course. An intimacy created for us for all time. Masonry is relationships. Not a business. Relationships between a man and his conscience, between one man and another, between conflicts and resolution, between receiving and giving back. Not accepting that relationships are a means, a formula, a route to discovery. This helps us understand why shop manuals created in earnest, replacing the intimacy with content, don't work. When you and I are receptive, a window into the mind opens by itself. That is learning. You and I can describe a relationship, but we cannot explain as easily the emotional currency, the nature of the man. When our actions and words are consistent, we communicate an authenticity, genuineness, and sincerity on which trust grows. Where does growth occur? Is it external? Is it an internal phenomena? Your growth. To prepare ourselves to expose our vulnerable moments, we begin with such a conversation. One never sees the validation of the great architect unless he looks for it. Neither does he understand his conceits and the areas peculiar to his character, known only to himself, that require his attention until he accepts responsibility. The threads of this are woven into hundreds of years of Masonic tapestry, hung as a connection and learning from the past. Thank you. Perhaps you hold on to your hats into jump into some of the perhaps the most profound piece of poetry I've ever addressed here on the sonic effects in what 10 or 11 years of our existence. 10 years, I guess. This is remarkable. This is a piece of work that has endured. Does it matter to you? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Unless you're curious, why has something like this endured for as long as it has? That's why when we listen to sort of the pop culture, the stuff that's transitory, you know, this disposable thing. Disposable music, disposable lyric. It doesn't really have much impact. These things, when we're comparing it, not so much within the emotional grasp of an individual, but within the collective psyche of humanity, stands out. Wonder why. Little is known about the life of the poet Homer. He's credited with being the first to write down the epic stories of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the impact of his tales continue to reverberate through Western culture. He was born sometime between the 12th and 8th century BC, possibly along the coast of Asia Minor. But he wouldn't have known at the time how much effect on Western culture his writings would have, but we don't know very much about him. So Homer is a mystery. The Iliad and the Odyssey is an enigma insofar as the actual facts of his life goes. And some scholars believe him to be one man. Others think these iconic stories were created by a group. A variation on the group idea stems from the fact that storytelling was an oral tradition. And Homer compiled the stories and then recited them to memory. His style, Homer's style, whoever he was, falls more in the category of minstrel poet or balladeer, as opposed to a cultivated poet who is the product of a fervent literary moment, such as Virgil or Shakespeare. The stories have repetitive elements, almost like a chorus or a refrain, which suggests a musical element. His works were designed as epic rather than lyric poetry, which originally recited with lyre in hand, much in the same vein as spoken word performances. The Iliad encompasses the story of the Trojan War. So some scholars have thought it fit to put the poet and chronicler nearer to the theme of that actual time. But others believe the poet's poetic style indicates a much later period. Greek historian Herodotus, 484 to 425, often called the father of history, placed Homer several centuries before him, around 850 BC. Part of the problem is that Homer lived before a chronological dating system was in place. The Olympic Games of classical Greece marked an epoch, with 776 BC as a starting point by which to measure out 4-year periods for the event. In short, it is difficult to give somebody a birth date when he was born before there was a calendar. And where was he born? Ionia, Smyrna, somewhere along the Asia Minor coast. Seven cities lay claim to Homer as their native son. Good for him. Good for them. The dialect that the Iliad and the Odyssey are written in is considered Asiatic Greek, specifically Ionic. In this, I'm going to read to you a piece from a copy that I picked up from my local library when it was so thumb-worn and falling apart that they had to get a new copy, and I got in line for the old copy. It's beautiful. The poet invokes a muse to aid him in telling the story of the rage of Achilles, the greatest Greek hero to fight in the Trojan War. And the narrative begins 9 years after the start of the war, as the Achaeans sack a Trojan allied town and capture two beautiful maidens, Chryseis and Briseis. Agamemnon, the commander-in-chief of the Achaean army, takes Chryseis as his prize, and Achilles, one of the Achaeans' most valuable warriors, claims Briseis. Chryseis' father, a man named Chryseis, who serves as a priest to the god Apollo, begs Agamemnon to return his daughter and offers to pay an enormous ransom. When Agamemnon refuses, Chryseis prays to Apollo for help. And then Apollo sends a plague upon the Greek camp, causing the death of many soldiers. And after 10 days of suffering, Achilles calls an assembly of the Achaean army and asks for a soothsayer to reveal the cause of the plague. Calchas, a powerful seer, stands up and offers his service, though he fears retribution from Agamemnon. Calchas reveals the plague as a vengeful and strategic move by Chryseis and Apollo. Agamemnon flies into a rage and says that he will return Chryseis only if Achilles gives him Briseis as compensation. Agamemnon's demands humiliate and infuriate the proud Achilles. The men argue, and Achilles threatens to withdraw from battle and take his people, the Myrmians, back home to Phthia. Agamemnon threatens to go to Achilles' tent and they army's camp and take Briseis for himself. Achilles stands poised to draw his sword and kill the Achaean commander when the goddess Athena, sent by Hera, the queen of the gods, appears to him and checks his anger. Oh, you're interested in the, 24 books of it? Here, just a sample. This is from the Rage of Achilles. Rage, goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, murderous, doomed, that cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death so many sturdy souls, great fighters' souls, but made their bodies carrion, feast for the dogs and birds, and the will of Zeus was moving toward its end. Begin, muse, when the two first broke and clashed, Agamemnon, lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. What god drove them to fight with such a fury? Apollo, the son of Zeus and Leto, incensed at the king, he swept a fatal plague through the army. Men were dying, and all because Agamemnon spurred Apollo's priest. Yes, Chryseis approached the Achilles' fast ships to win his daughter back, bringing a priceless ransom and bearing high in hand, wound on a golden staff, the wreaths of the god and the distant deadly archer. He begged the whole Achaean army, but most of all the two supreme commanders, Atreus' two sons, Agamemnon and Menelaus, all Argives geared for war. May the gods who hold the halls of Olympus give you Priam's city to plunder. Then safe passage home and set my daughter free, my dear one here, accept these gifts, this ransom. Honor the God who strikes from worlds away, the son of Zeus, Apollo. The story that illustrates suffering and courage. Brilliant. My goodness. Just amazing. Just amazing. Mm-hmm. Here. I'm going to share with you some just a small briefing on symbolism, bringing that forward. Sometimes when I'm going through this material with you, it makes me wonder about wishing in some ways that we could go back to the days, to those, I know they're ideals, you know, I wasn't there, they probably weren't as glorious as they're remembered, but nevertheless, the idea that there were only certain lodges that performed ritual, and it makes me think that the ritual was heightened, it was taken very seriously and purposefully and performed exquisitely. And that last part's probably a bit of my own ego or my conceit. I think ritual, in order to be absorbed by the candidate, needs to be performed flawlessly. And it's unnerving to watch a piece, a ritual, stopped while we wait for a speaker, a character to prance up to deliver his line, and then wait while he prances back to his seat, and wait while another fellow prances up to his mark, as if there's no cue, no thought that this is to be done with a sense of continuity that respects the learner, the person that's never heard it before. I find that quite unnerving and a variation, to be quite candid with you, a variation on ritual that we're bound to avoid. And where I am, we're seeing the measure of that, the litmus test. People are not returning, you're not absorbing the information because they're not receiving it. When you go through a night like that and you ask what you recall, often the 99% of the work, the flawlessness is interrupted by the poor performance. The character that didn't know his lines or dropped them or flubbed them repeatedly. Hardly the kind of impression we intend to make, I would hope, my goodness. Anyway, it's all part of human nature in a way, but I'm not able to excuse it. And here, Freemasonry allows us to challenge that in a way. So that's where my imagination goes when I'm listening to this material, studying it, and learning it. Today we're going to dive into the installed master's apron and the past master's jewel. Oh, if any of you are there trying to supplant the notion of privacy or secrecy, my goodness, you only have to examine your own heart to know that you couldn't be further from the truth. This material is shared. It's not the secret. The secret is in... The secret of masonry is in you. It's in you. You can struggle for words to describe it, but nevertheless, that experience, you know the one I'm talking about, that experience is within you. It's experiential, of course. It's the only way you acquire that knowledge. What does it feel like? It feels like ABC. Mm-hmm. Never quite. It's like that plus the imagination of the man. The secret. On the apron of a brother who has been installed in the chair of a lodge, there are placed, instead of rosettes, devices which have come for some reason to be known as levels. J.S.M. Ward, in an interpretation of the Masonic symbols, declares that they cannot be levels and sees them as three tau crosses and models of the architect's T-square. As the master of the lodge is in the position of the architect, he sees this decoration as appropriate. A glance at the Book of Constitutions, in which there is a description of the apron to be worn by masters and past masters of lodges, would have told him that the device is perpendicular lines upon horizontal lines, therefore forming three several sets of two right angles. This description has continued unchanged since the device was first introduced in 1814. That's a fun fact, and seems to reflect a fashion at about the time in Masonic history of a special reverence for the ability to raise a perpendicular. The same description appears in the constitutions of the Grand Lodge of Scotland with the addition, in imitation of a rude level, which is no doubt the reason the devices are so called. It is from the same period that the regular steps date, and these, if carefully made from the standing position described in documents of the period, give precisely the same effect. This ability to create right angles has long been considered as a special Masonic secret, and there is a school of thought which believes that this ability, requiring three separate measurements, was a secret lost through the death of H.A., and that development in the last quarter of the 18th century changed these matters to what we now have. With the confusion in the same period over the status of Master Mason and Master of the Lodge, before there was as much in installation as there now is in England, the reaffirmation of the ability to form a right angle as the status symbol of an installed master seems very proper. In the same book, Ward refers to the device of the 47th proposition of Euclid, which in England is the jewel which distinguishes a past master. This is peculiar to the English constitution and to some other constitutions which owe their formations to England. It is not found in many of the older obediences. This proposition also has particular reference to a right angle in relation to a triangle and is amongst the oldest formal devices connected with the English Grand Lodge. It appeared on the frontispiece on page of the 1723 Book of Constitutions, which also commented on pages 21. But his scholar, the greater Pythagoras, proved the author of the 47th proposition of Euclid's first book, which, if duly observed, is the foundation of all masonry, sacred, civil, and military. The connection with Pythagoras was sufficient to make it acceptable as a Masonic problem, emblem. While there are several instances of these concerned with the changes of 1814 and later, going back to Anderson's constitutions for inspiration. In this connection, Ward says, in medieval days, one of the most valuable building secrets was how to plot out the ground plan of a building. And the key to this was the correct use of the right-angled triangle. How to construct and then to use this right-angled triangle was a jealously guarded secret of the master builder. And though when we know how to do it, we can see it, simplicity itself. To the more ignorant craftsman, it must have remained a complete mystery. In the operative lodges, which still exist, the members are informed that the secret which the villains wished to discover was this, which in those days was concealed in the words, in the use of three rods, one 3 cubits long, one 4 cubits long, and one 5 cubits long. These rods were the insignia of office of the three grand masters. And when placed together in the form of a right-angled triangle in the center of a piece of ground on which the building was to be raised, the three masters could plot out a building. Again, here is confusion between what was considered master mason work and the device of an installed master, pointing to the late development of installation as a full right. Ward also mentions that in the Scottish constitution, the past master wears a letter G on part of his jewel. In old tracing boards of the third degree in England, the letter G is also found. And it has a different explanation than that of the second degree board. The old lectures tell us that it is a reference to those specially able stone masons, known as the building of the temple as Giblum, men from the town of Gibble or Gebel, and sometimes translated as stone squarers, again a reference to the speciality of being able to work in squares. This G in Old English practice is an essential part of the third degree, but the letter disappears with third degree tracing boards after the Union of 1813. Despite the fact that the Geblum are mentioned in the 1723 constitutions. If only we could knock on the door of J.S.M. Ward and find out what in the world he was thinking.
Thank you.
Wraps it up for today. Freemasonry provides us with a context for the exploration of our nature. Yeah, maybe it is that, as Aristotle cited, that we become what we do repetitively. So, nothing at all wrong with a man becoming charitable because he performs acts of charity. Nothing wrong with a man being curious or observant or quiet. No need to compete and be gregarious when that's not your nature. But always respectful of the context that is the nature of Freemasonry. Unending, eh? Never quite ends. Thank you, though. Unlike in Freemasonry, this program does come to an end. I hope you've enjoyed the work today. And I hope you found the ideas soothing or comfortable or challenging, and the music galvanizing, bringing us together. Until we can sit down again and enjoy a conversation, leaning in again. Make sure, just think about this as we go through the week. Where we try to make Freemasonry conform with our contemporary text, context, it seems to fail until we grasp the stream of what's been going on through history. For if we're not students, then that means that we fall back on trusting the scholars around us. It's embracing the idea that there's something bigger than us, bigger than our ego, bigger than our conscience. It's accepting the notion that humility is an aspect of true leadership. Masonry, finding what inspires. So as you go through your week performing those acts of random Masonic kindness, be kind to yourself. Employ imagination within the bounds of good taste and grace that are taught to us by Masonic ritual and history and our philosophy. Always. Not about going off on tangents, but feeling comfortable. It's not just straining at the notion of compliance or uniformity, but being comfortable with it because we understand. We understand the nature. Anyway, I look forward to seeing you again. It's going to be September the next time we're together. I wish you all well. See you soon. Little Billie Holiday, the way you look tonight. Thank you.
Touches my